Welcome to Transform Now, a podcast focused on intelligent automation and brought to you by SS&C Blue Prism. On this program, we talk about how organizations globally are rethinking the way they operate, utilizing process orchestration and AI-enabled digital workers to free up humans to do the work that matters most. We also share insights and tips on how you can embrace this new way of working and unleash your full potential. Let's get into the show.
Hello, everyone. I'm Michael Marchuk. Welcome to the Transform Now podcast. Our guest on this episode is Brent Kanzerski. Brent stands out as a pioneering thought leader in human performance and industry with a career marked by innovative insights and transformative impacts. His expertise is recognized by top publications, and his webinars are highly regarded in the field. With a rich background as a global HR strategist for Shell and founder of HumanWorks, Brent is a fervent advocate for the human-centric industry approach. Currently, contributes as Hexagon's principal industrial strategist and sits on the advisory board to support the passing of the Workplace Psychological Safety Act through Congress. Welcome, Brent. You sound like a busy guy.
Hey, thank you, Michael. Good to be here with you today.
I'm so glad you are here. You're an industry veteran, and in so many senses of that word, and I suspect that my intro left out a whole lot of details. So tell us a little bit more about yourself and this whole human-centric approach to this digital transformation concept.
Sure. Actually, my entire career, nearly almost 40 years, when I started my undergraduate degree in kind of industrial organizational psych, I did my internships in power companies. After I graduated, I went to DC and I worked for government-based agencies, high-risk agencies, and it was always around human centricity and people doing dangerous things, whether it was the military, whether it was government or the Border Patrol or FBI or Bureau of Prisons or nuclear, all those things. And I really got a sense of when people are in harm's way, how important is it to not only prepare them and ready them to perform safely and consistently, but also what's it feel like to work in those scenarios and conditions, and what's the human experience like beyond just being vigilant and safe? So I always got into those kind of things, and I ended up working my way into Shell, where I spent a quarter century kind of professionalizing their HR curriculum, I guess you'd call it, their capacity in terms of a global workforce and what that means to be a global workforce.
You've got a very deep understanding of a number of different industries in this in context. How do you perceive this evolution of intelligent automation within this historical context? Especially since you're coming from this sort of dangerous role perspective. Accountants, I think, would probably find their most dangerous role is maybe a paper cut, something like that. So you start transitioning from intelligent automation in maybe heavy industry, but now to intelligent automation in an office setting.
As a kind of a historian, and especially like an industrial historian, I look at these things because, again, my career has been about transformation and change and the psychology of change and things like that. I go back, and if you think about the U.S., because the U.S. is a great ecosystem for studying industry because we started from scratch and from the 1600s, and then we've, in 200 years, we morphed to be the world's leading industrial society. The first American factory is about 1780 or 90, Slater's Mill up in New England, and it made textiles. Eli Whitney created the cotton gin, and the thing about that big first piece of technology and automation is that you were now able to separate the seeds from the cotton faster. And at that time, cotton was called white gold. And so what that meant is they needed more bigger plantations, more cotton fields to grow the cotton. And then that basically created that mass industry. Now, out of that, when they started to migrate north and west, they started to work on things like the railroads. They created their own folk hero called John Henry. John Henry was a steel worker, and he faced the challenge of automation. So he dealt with the hammer, and instead of making tunnels and things with the hammer, they had this steam drill. So he was fighting technology. So it was the man versus machine and the exploitation of workers. And so anyways, the point of all this is that the American society created folklore to help them understand the working class, the importance of coexisting with technology and things like that. Now, as all that evolved, again, I just told you from 1793 to about 1920, then the last character is a guy named Joe Magarac. And Joe Magarac was created by, after the steel strikes of Homestead in 1889, and then the later strikes in the early 1900s. And this guy was created to represent the immigrants that were coming into the steel mills. Anyways, but he was portrayed as a superhuman steelworker. The bad side of this is, as the workers were creating this character to be an advocate for them, U.S. Steel, United States Steel Corporation, picked him up and promoted him as their image of the perfect worker. So he was 7 feet tall. He could do the work of 30 men. He worked tirelessly. He wasn't married. He didn't have a family. He spent all his day at work. He didn't do any vacations. And all he was a content and happy worker. And so this guy emphasized loyalty to the company. He did 24-hour shifts. He never went on strike. And so the company picked him up to say, this is what we think the super worker is, and we want you all to be a super worker. And they actually even created comic books around this guy. They passed it around to the workers' children. They wanted to create a society that the worker was a dedicated person. So anyways, so you have all this. And what this all means is that we were trained and conditioned for the last 200 plus years to fear automation, whether it's the steam shovel, whether it's whatever industry was. Every industry had their folklore hero. And so everybody was basically conditioned to fear automation. So here we are today, and we still fear automation. That's the backdrop. So when people today are worrisome of automation, we've got a 200+ year history of fearing it and being conditioned to fear it.
Like, that makes sense to me, to understand the conditioning part, because it wasn't just something that the computer came out and then people started being afraid of more automation. It really has been a longstanding thing as technology just in general has advanced throughout this. So as we look at the current landscape and you're looking at intelligent automation entering into office spaces and such, where do you see that across these various sectors in today's economy?
The big picture, if you look at work today, what people do in industry, whether it's retail, construction, oil and gas, whatever it might be, the prediction or the estimate is that there can be a range from 45 to 75% of all of today's work could be automated. Now, that doesn't mean that it should be, because we say it could be. When I was at Shell, there was always a lot of energy around automating things. Now, my advocacy was you always automate the Ds: dull, dirty, dangerous, demanding work. And that's the easy stuff, because you want to get people out of harm's way. You want to use a drone instead of having somebody go up to a high ladder on a tower. You want to use a sensor instead of getting someone in a confined space. So you look at all these technologies, and the first thing as a society we want to do is get rid of the work that degrades people or puts people in dangerous scenarios. So that's the first thing. But what happened along the way is that companies didn't have a real intellectual scheme on what do you automate and what do you humanate and what do you cope on. And if you think about this, you have to think about, you always want to upskill and reskill workers. And you want to, so let's get the category of dangerous, the Ds, out of the way. We're going to automate all that stuff. But then you want the stuff that you can increase human capacity in terms of cognition, collaboration, and creativity with automation. For example, in the past, you might have had a worker that spent 60% of their day hunting and pecking for information. They had to go find data and make sense out of it and aggregate it, put it together. And today, they don't need to waste their time searching. That can be done with automation. Now they take that 60% of the time and they use that data to be more creative, more collaborative, more cognitive. So it's those kind of things. And then you don't want to like automate work that people add value to. A machine cannot collaborate very well with other people. It can't be really creative with those things. So you don't want to automate those things. And you don't want to automate things that people actually like to do. They feel purpose and value. So you don't automate work where that work was giving people a real connection to the job, to the organization, and things like that. So there's a whole algorithm around when do you automate, when do you not. And the big thing, the push we've got to do today is we've got to use automation and get to this. Because again, phase one was automate the D's. Phase two is how do you build technology and automation that amplifies the human being? Because that's going to create new jobs. It's going to inspire workers and engage workers so we get out of this issue around disengagement, disenfranchisement in work. And it's going to build skills, new skills that elevates the wage because people are now are not doing menial work. They're doing more thoughtful work. And it's going to create a new channel and pipeline to promote industries.
So you brought up an interesting term, humanate. Automation versus humanation, and knowing the difference between those activities. When you see the advancements in AI and the inherent capabilities that these newer systems are bringing into the automated components, you talked about creativity. There's loads of new AIs now that they're able to create songs and create images and follow multi-level tasks to be able to support that. But one of the aspects you brought up is when you should do this and when you shouldn't do this. Do you have any kind of rule of thumb? You mentioned the concept of taking the joy out of a role or that sort of thing. But are there any other reasons why a company would choose to humanate a role versus automate it? And how would they coordinate work between that?
Right. I always look at things from the human work cycle. The human work cycle starts with there's some kind of initiation cue, tells me when to do work, whether it's scheduled or unscheduled maintenance or whether something goes in the environment that triggers, hey, you got to do something. You can automate the queuing of work. Okay. So that's great. So people don't have to always be looking around. It's more like the environment will tell you when something needs to be done. So automate that kind of stuff. Then the next thing the human work cycle does is they get to the job, they get to the task, and there's a sense making. They look around and say, okay, what's my environment saying before I start the work? And you can then automate the sense making, like the analysis of information. It can say, hey, you're standing in front of the hydrocracker. It's 68 degrees. That means this might be at play. That might. So it gives them nudges and things. But then they use their big brain to make bigger sense out of all those little inputs they get. Then they actually do the work. And what happens when you do the work is you're getting incoming information. So automate all the incoming information, but the human makes sense of that information from a collaborative, creative, a cognitive bit. And then what happens is the human runs into troubleshooting, problem solving, decision making, and collaboration. And all those things, the meat of troubleshooting, problem solving, decision making, collaboration, and all that's the human aspect. You want the value of the human being, the intellect. But all the things that support those things, you automate. And again, because what you always want to do is humans want to be assisted with decisions, assisted with troubleshooting. They want to be at the tip of the spear in actually making the final decision. So again, if you think about human performance support, automation should be providing a human performance support environment, but the big lifting and shifting should be done by humans. Because humans, guess what? They love to feel purposeful in making a decision, making a creative idea, collaborating, expanding value, and all those kind of things. Again, that's my basic model is the humanation versus automation is what does automation do to get rid of the D's, the dull stuff, the dangerous stuff, but what does it do to enhance the next generation of humans? For example, my son, a Gen Zer, he's an engineer at a chemical plant, and he doesn't want to do stuff that I did when I was 20 years old at work, me hunting and pecking for things and making copies and doing all this kind of transactional stuff I had to do in the office. He wants all that stuff done for him, like a little wizard that's doing it for him. And then he wants to do the big mental blocks. So he wants to use his mind. He wants to use his relationships. He wants to use his ability to do this moonshot thinking. Instead of incremental, he wants to do 10 times change. So that's what we need to get humans to do, is that 10 times impact of their effort. So again, it's a new equation of human effort, really, with automation. That's what you need to look at.
Yeah, that makes sense. And you brought up a thing about purpose as well. Purpose can be something that people find in their role, but it also, that's what drives all this stuff. There's a purpose behind the company. There's a purpose behind the activities that are happening that people have to support and determine. Some of it may be regulatory, where there's a requirement that goes into place. But a lot of it is, it's regulatory because the organization that we're part of has chosen to be part of that. Our purpose is to fulfill some role within a particular industry, whether it's banking or something else. The fact is that there's a purpose behind that, and that purpose ends up being human-centered to start with. So having people migrating towards that purpose allows them to stay in more human-centric type roles versus, as you mentioned, the sort of transactional activities that happen with automation. So splitting those two tends to make a lot of sense when you are evaluating the strengths of both types of kind of output. So you have human output with their various strengths, and then the digital worker intelligent automation component with their types of strengths. So as we get towards this balance, how do we balance this technological growth with the economic sustainability as intelligent automation and AI sort of progress? How do we keep that balance?
Right. It's a great question, because from a workforce, global workforce perspective, we've got 8 point something billion people in the world today. Every country has its GDP. If you think about the world by 2030 or 2040, there's going to be 11 point something billion people. That means we have to find 3+ billion more jobs to have a GDP that is sustainable, to have the quality of life that people want. And then you've got the wage issue. People talk about universal basic income because of all these problems and things. And I don't think industry's thinking about it well enough. And they're not preparing for these things. So again, I go back to the talk we had about automation. We are certainly going to automate the repetitive, rule-based, high-volume, low-variability kinds of tasks and work. So I predict in the future, we're not going to have those kinds of jobs. So anything that's repetitive, it's assembly line, data entry work, anything like that's gone. And if you look at the world today and the number of jobs that are in those categories, it's a big number. How do you replace those? What they'll be replaced with is the tasks that require empathy, creativity, critical thinking, complex decision making, social skills. So we're going to have much more customer service and much more design and negotiation kind of jobs and skill. And our universities will have to adapt and change. Our trade schools will have to adapt and change. So if I look at my kind of my pie chart of today, where the percentages of jobs are and skills are versus tomorrow, it's quite different, but we're not preparing for that. And that's the big problem that we're having. We're not preparing for automation to really do it strategically. We're taking automation, and companies and industry are addressing automation tactically. And what I mean by that, they're doing it today. So I often say to folks, people will exchange the easier choice today to get rid of the hard choice tomorrow. And so what I mean by that is they're doing easy stuff today. Doing the easy stuff today is going to make tomorrow a lot harder, a lot more difficult. I remember years ago, I had a manager that would walk around the office to see how many people were sitting working at their desks. And if you were sitting working at your desk, you were a good boy or a good girl. And I hated that motto because I was always out and about dealing with people. I was running the show and doing things. And in the future, I don't want people sitting at their desk being good boys and girls. I want them using their brain. I want them interacting. I want them going and tugging and pulling on stuff. So this is this whole design of the future of work. There's just not a lot of thought leadership into it. And people are just hoping through osmosis, it'll get done.
All right. So I have a question for you, more practical. You're speaking to an HR team today in any one of these large organizations. What practical advice would you give them as you're looking at, in the context of what you just mentioned, to get them moving towards the right direction for the future state that you see coming in the next 6 years,
right?
2030s, right around the corner.
Seeing the big issues. You take the typical HR person. I mean, they work on trends and they deal with, for example, like McKinsey put out the study, the war for talent in the late 90s. All the HR people did is they said, oh, it's a war for talent. Let's get on that boat. And so what they did is they tried to make their companies attractive to bring people in, to bring the, so they were fighting for the best talent, the war for talent. They were short-sighted because they brought all these people in, but companies couldn't keep them because they had a lousy work experience. The company didn't build the human experience. So they brought people in and it was like a big factory of bringing people in faster and all that, but people didn't stay. So now we're in this mode of, okay, now you bring the people in, now you got to keep them, and you keep them through having a more engaging, productive, prosperous, purposeful experience. So that's one thing. Then the other thing, when I work at companies today, they're all having, especially an industrial job, they're all having attraction problems because the low wage sweet spot of $20, $25, they're competing with jobs that offer workers much more autonomy and much clearer purpose. So why would you work in a manufacturing plant for $20 an hour and have some kind of crazy line supervisor that's making, you know, $30 an hour that isn't properly trained to be a leader or not to treat you as a human? And when you can go drive an Amazon Prime truck and be by yourself all day and have autonomy and do what you want to do, and you're in total control of your purpose. So it's those kind of things that are happening. Or you can go be a waiter and waitress, make your $2.50 an hour, but you're getting big tips based on how you control your autonomy. That's the thing. And so the HR professionals, the businesses, aren't looking long-term about why do we have the attrition issues? Why can't we keep people? Why is it taking us longer to onboard people and get them to time to productivity? Because they haven't changed their thinking. They're still, companies are still onboarding the same way, which is terrible. They haven't changed their onboarding practices since the 1970s, probably. They aren't changing their job design practices. They're just not doing the work that there's so much science research behind to do.
Is that a culture issue, or is it an issue with training in the HR profession?
I think that overall training, people development, HR, these are all stepchild industries and companies because they're considered functions. Anybody can do them. And because we put people in roles, whether it be HR or learning, that came from the operations side, we don't have classically trained people in these roles. So it degrades the credibility of these functions. So everybody thinks, well, you're just Sam or Joe or Jill or Sheila, and anybody can do those roles. So there's no mastery behind them. There's no science behind them. There's no academia behind them. And so don't worry about it. They're not looking at the neuroscience of learning, the neuroscience of purpose at work. So all this stuff that we have this great research and these experts around, companies just aren't implementing it. And it drives me crazy because they can be addressing the worker experience with this kind of insight, but they're not doing it.
Yeah, that makes sense. Brent, you have led us down a bunch of different avenues today. And I really appreciate your insights, especially given your experience you've had over multiple industries over quite a long time, to give us a perspective of the changing roles that people are seeing within the jobs today and where these things could be going. So I want to thank you again for joining us today to give us your insights.
Thank you, Mike. It was great to be on the call with you.
Thank you for listening to Transform Now, the podcast from SS&C Blue Prism. You can find all of our episodes on your favorite podcast channel, as well as YouTube. To stay on top of the hottest topics in the world of intelligent automation, subscribe now. The future of work is here.